Is the off-ramp to de-escalation in sight, or did Benjamin Netanyahu's government deliberately blow past it? If achieving the stated aim of killing Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar offers Israel a reason to relent in Gaza and Lebanon, that has yet to happen. The days since have been particularly lethal. Airstrikes near Beirut targeting Hezbollah's financial assets overnight, just as U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein was touching down to talk ceasefire conditions. We'll ask if we're witnessing what you could call the storm before the calm, or if there is no plan to de-escalate. With the U.S. Secretary of State following Hochstein, Israel mindful of growing pressure from its allies, organizing press tours for journalists to show renewed aid deliveries to the Gaza Strip. But the UN accuses Israeli authorities of continuing to obstruct delivery of that critical aid. On that score, France's president suggesting Sinwar's death, quote, must be an opportunity to begin a new phase of negotiation. We'll get the panel's take on Emmanuel Macron's latest pronouncements and the verbal jousting we've seen between him and Netanyahu. Today, in the France 24 debate, we're looking what next after the death of the Hamas leader. And joining us, former ambassador to Qatar and Saudi Arabia, Bertrand Besancenot. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks as well to Gil Mihaly, editor-in-chief of the news website Causeur. How are you?
Great, thank you.
From Washington, Bilal Saab is head of the U.S. Middle East practice at the Trends Research and Advisory Consultancy. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24Debate. Yeah, across Lebanon, there were strikes against nearly a dozen branches of a credit union where ordinary citizens keep their savings. It's under U.S. sanctions. Israel calls Al-Qard Al-Hassan as a Hezbollah-run institution used to finance attacks. Eliza Herbert has more.
These dense plumes of smoke nearby Beirut's only commercial airport were not alone in the city's skyline after 10 Israeli strikes battered the Lebanese capital overnight. The Israel Defense Force claims it was targeting areas linked to the Al-Qard Al-Hassan Association, a group it says is financing Hezbollah's operations.
In the coming days, we will reveal how Iran funds Hezbollah's terror activities by using civilian institutions, associations, and NGOs, which act as a cover for terrorist activity. We will attack them during the night, and we'll provide an update on the results of the attack in the next few days.
The Al-Qard Al-Hassan Association is a financial organization sanctioned by the United States, with more than 30 branches across Lebanon, including 15 in densely populated parts of Beirut. They are often located on the ground floors of residential buildings, such as here, where locals were filmed in the early hours of Monday morning inspecting the damage. A whole building appeared flattened before them. The Israeli Defense Forces issued evacuation orders before the strikes, causing hundreds of people to flee their homes in panic. Just hours earlier, the U.S. Secretary of Defense said he would like to see Israel rein in its military operations.
The numbers of casualties have been, civilian casualties have been far too high. We'd like to see Israel scale back on some of the strikes that it's taking, especially in and around Beirut.
On the Israeli side of the border, sirens rang out near Haifa, as Hezbollah claimed it fired rockets at three military bases in Israel's north.
And there have been more rockets since intercepted. We are also joined by journalist Dalal Mawad, the author of All She Lost, The Explosion in Lebanon, The Collapse of a Nation, and The Women Who Survived. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate. I'll begin with you, Dalal. You saw in that report the images from overnight in your native Lebanon. What did you think listening to that clip of Lloyd Austin, the U.S. Defense Secretary?
Well, we've heard this before, François, from the Americans, you know, saying this is not acceptable, calling for a ceasefire. But we're not seeing, you know, any leverage being used by the Americans to push the Israelis for, you know, accepting a ceasefire. We know that Hochstein is visiting Lebanon today, and he's come with a proposal. The U.S. is engaged in an increased pressure on the political establishment in Lebanon for the election of a president. And we could go into the details of what the U.S. wants. I think at this stage, it is really trying to change the political landscape in Lebanon, banking on the fact that Hezbollah has been weakened militarily after its leadership has been decapitated.
And what do you think on that score of the targeting of these, I guess you could call them, they're more credit unions than they are actual banks. What do you make of it?
Yes. I'm glad you're asking about this because Qard al-Hassan is, as you mentioned in the report, is not really a bank, right? It's a financial institution that provides microcredit. You can call it an informal bank. It's very much a parallel financing system that's not regulated by the Lebanese central bank or the banking sector. But it's, I think, targeting these financial institutions that, by the way, provide credit to an estimated 400,000 Lebanese civilians is very much a blow to Hezbollah's social and economic institutions and that society within the society that it has been able to build in Lebanon or a state within the state. But at the same time, I mean, the question is, to what extent are these this institution used to channel military funding to Hezbollah? There's a real question mark here. We don't know. It's been used by the U.S. maybe since the sanctions in 2007 to channel illicit funds of Hezbollah to engage in money laundering. But at the end of the day, there are civilians, as I mentioned, who take microcredits. It's an Islamic banking system, Francois, where people take a credit by putting a jewelry or gold as a mortgage. And the interest rates are very low or almost like none. There are no interest rates. And a lot of people have been able to take this credit to engage in activities such as, you know, buying things or a wedding or just like regular things and not, you know, it allowed the constituency of Hezbollah, which is the majority of people benefiting from those banks, to kind of take a credit after the collapse of the financial system in Lebanon. So we see that actually the activity of Qard al-Hassan increased since 2019, since the collapse of the banks in Lebanon. And today, you know, until 2022, it was providing, according to estimates, around 2 billion loans to Lebanese civilians. And the question is today, okay, if we're saying these institutions are engaging in illicit funding, helping Hezbollah militarily, but does that mean that if this is a legitimate target, then hospitals affiliated to Hezbollah are legitimate targets? The schools affiliated to Hezbollah are legitimate targets? Hezbollah is not just a military organization. It's built a community in Lebanon, as I mentioned, a society within a society, and there are real questions.
Yeah, so let me put that question to Gil Mihaly now. Gil, this is credit unions that are under U.S. sanctions
and Saudi sanctions too.
But there have been civilians killed and. The cost-benefit ratio here, when you're attacking credit unions like this, are we back to the 2006 scenario where Israel's running low on legitimate targets?
I have no idea. You have no idea. We don't know. I think what we should do is try and stay on the 30,000 feet point of view, because we don't know exactly what's the damage. We don't know exactly what these people do. We know, for example, that it's not only a pawn broker. It was also, they had a lot of cash that was destroyed. It's not only the jewelry. These are cultures where women wear the saving accounts of the family, bracelets, and so they use it. Jewelry is part of the saving.
But what you're describing sounds like Mission Impossible, trying to... If you're trying to cut off all of Hezbollah's financial, bomb away Hezbollah's credit lines, it sounds impossible.
You don't. If you try to do anything, there will always be someone who will tell you that it's counterproductive or impossible. Then you should better stay home and do nothing. The idea is that Israel took the risk after 2006 to live with extremely dangerous capacities of Hezbollah, Because in Israel, they believed that they can negotiate the tensions. They will have tens of thousands of rockets. They have infantry that is capable of surprising Israel like the Hamas did in the north and make a lot of damage. But as long as there is an understanding that we keep this under control, Israel could live with this capacity. What happened in October last year, the 7th with Hamas, the 8th with Hezbollah, is that Israel cannot longer live with capacities because there's the problem of the intention, and neither UNIFIL nor the government of Lebanon can assure Israel of a minimum level of security. So the idea now is to try to hit Hezbollah as hard as possible, to deprive Hezbollah of the possibility to attack Israel by land easily, to diminish without annihilating, because it's impossible, his rocket and missile capacities, and to try and weaken Hezbollah as much as possible, so that after, we are talking about preparing the day after. In the day after, the diplomatic track is to try and give the Lebanese a maneuvering room in order to create a system where Hezbollah is domesticated. And at the, until that day, Israel would like to have the right, recognized right, to intervene in order to avoid the reconstruction of Hezbollah's capacities. The same logic is for Gaza.
Bilal Saab, do you see the hitting of these microcredit unions with that the Israelis, when they're doing it, do it with an eye to, as Gil describes it, the day after?
Well, there's always a limit to hitting physical infrastructure. At the end of the day, these are physical locations, right? I mean, my understanding is that the operators demand these 31 branches have already emptied them of any real currency or gold. Now, some of it may have been deployed fine. At the end of the day, you still have the internet to do financial transactions. But I find this all being consistent with the words and the plan of the Israeli defense minister when he said that we've moved on now in the campaign, transitioned from degrading the military capabilities of Hezbollah to actually defeating. And when you start talking about defeating it, whatever your definition, that means you're going after multiple levers of power of the organization, and now they're going after the financial capabilities of the organization. Whether that's going to be effective, we can, you know, debate that until the cows come home. But that I find consistent with the messaging of the Israelis, which was communicated by the Minister of Defense very recently.
Right, and so that brings us to, again, back to the diplomacy aspect of things. We have Joe Biden's special envoy to the region, Amos Hochstein, in Lebanon this Monday ahead of his visit. Israel reportedly spelling out conditions for a ceasefire. The news website Axios saying, though, that a U.S. official thought it highly unlikely Lebanon and the international community would agree to them, which saying they would dramatically undermine Lebanon's sovereignty, insisting he doesn't want to negotiate in public. That's what he told reporters this Monday. Amos Hochstein pointing to that 2006 United Nations resolution that calls for a buffer zone in the south where only Lebanon's regular army and UN peacekeepers, UNIFIL, are allowed to patrol.
1701 was successful at ending the war in 2006. But we must be honest that no one did anything to implement it. The lack of implementation over those years contributed to the conflict that we are in today. That must change, because both sides simply committing to 1701 is just not enough.
Bertrand Besancenot, both sides committing to 1701 is not enough, he says. Your reaction to that?
Oh, I think that on one hand, nobody is really crying about the death of Sinwar, and everybody is trying to convince Netanyahu that maybe it should be the time to seize this opportunity to negotiate, even in a strong position, but to negotiate and to try to find a kind of arrangement. Of course, the common position of the international community is the implementation of 1701. Now, it is clear that there might be some arrangement that has to be done, taking into account the new realities on the spot, certainly. But it has to be the aim which is accepted by everybody, because otherwise it means that we won't have any agreement. And some people do think, and I think they are right, that Mr. Netanyahu, for the time being, thinks that he has a window of opportunity to realize what are his ambitions. So now that the Hamas has been...
How do you see those ambitions? What ambitions are...
Well, clearly to destroy all the elements that are threatening Israel. So the Hamas has been in a large way put out, of course, if I may say. Now it is the turn of the Hezbollah, which has started to attack Israel on the 8th of October. But the reality is now that they are trying to eliminate as much rockets and other things, but also personalities from the Hezbollah, which has been done, with one question mark. Up to where Mr. Netanyahu wants to go. And some people are expecting that he wants to go as far as possible because he has a free hand for the time being, because the Americans are in a campaign and the pressure from the American side is very limited on Netanyahu.
So you
agree Netanyahu.
You agree with what Dalal said at the beginning when she listened to the U.S. Defense Secretary, that those words won't matter much.
Yes. No. And so this is the problem, and many people expect that he's hoping to see Mr. Trump winning the election and then going to the what they call the head of the octopus, which means Iran, trying to destroy also the military capabilities that are threatening Israel. But of course, there is a big question mark. Nobody knows what will be the outcome of the election in the U.S. This is one point. And second, nobody knows if at some point Mr. Netanyahu will find his interest in negotiating. But this is a question mark, of course.
And after Amos Hochstein, Bilal Saab, it's going to be the 11th visit to the region by the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken since October 7th of last year. Listening to Ambassador Besancenot, is he wasting his? Is it a waste of time, this diplomacy, since we just have to wait until November the 5th to find out who wins the U.S. presidential election?
That's a fair question. I hope that the answer to that is not that they're wasting their time. I hope that there's some kind of seriousness in this diplomacy. But the details of Lebanese diplomacy are not in the hands of Secretary Blinken. It's in the hands of Amos Hochstein. And what they're pushing for, at least let's start with the Israeli demands, because I find them quite unrealistic. And frankly, they're non-starters. The Americans agree to those, frankly. If you want the Israelis to be the enforcers of any kind of new version of 1701, that's a complete non-starter. And so I don't know why they're pushing for diplomacy if they are putting a condition to enforce it themselves and then also Lebanese airspace whenever they want. Frankly, they've been doing that for many, many years. They don't really need the permission of anybody to do that. So to have that even in a document is a complete non-starter. They frankly want to bestow some legitimacy to whatever actions that they want. And as weak as the Lebanese state is, they're not going to throw the they're not going to agree to something this egregious and frankly embarrassing in many ways to the Lebanese. So I understand that we've had challenges, we as an international community have had challenges enforcing 1701, but to have a belligerent in this conflict try to enforce it themselves is a complete non-starter.
And Gil Mihaly, the Israelis know that it's a non-starter? This is just, again, part of the bargaining process?
What's the alternative? In 2006, there was a reinforced UNIFIL, because UNIFIL was changed three or four times. The first force was 78, and then it changed, and when after the Israeli withdrawal, it changed again. And in 2006, it was a reinforced. They have almost 11,000 men on the ground. They have means, and it didn't work. So the alternative is the Lebanese army. Can we trust the Lebanese army? Not immediately. So who else? American soldiers? Is the United States ready to do that? I don't know, Saudis, Emiratis. I think that Israel will. This is my estimation, that Israel will not move on the right to fly over, so they can verify what's going on the ground. But if there is, and maybe for 5 or 10 years, but if there is a credible force that will, for 6 months or a year, will show that it is efficient and effective, I don't see why Israel should not agree to that.
Adam Awad, of course, all this would be a lot easier if Lebanon had a president. Parliament, I believe, was supposed to convene today in committees, but it hasn't met much in the last 2 months.
No, as I mentioned earlier, François, there's an increased pressure from the U.S. specifically to elect a president. And I think there are a lot of foreign decision makers here, including the Americans, who may seem to think that this is a good time to press, you know, on the advantage that Hezbollah has weakened to push for a president. But I don't think anyone is thinking of the repercussions of the timing. I think we are in a very delicate position here, trying to sideline one part of the Lebanese. At the end of the day, Hezbollah represents one of Lebanon's largest communities. It has, you know, become part of what I would say the Shia identity in Lebanon. And to press for a president now, which most of the Lebanese would agree on, including me, we do want a president. This political void has been ongoing for more than almost two years. But I think that the timing is dangerous, because how are you going to do this if you're going to marginalize Hezbollah in this decision-making? A key person here would be the Speaker of Parliament, Nabih Berri, who is trying to play the role of a mediator. But there are also talks about sanctioning Berri, which I've read in U.S. media, in case he doesn't go ahead with the election of a president soon, you know, and takes advantage of the weakening of Hezbollah. Is that the right thing to do when this man could be the one who kind of brings in Hezbollah to the table? So to go back to my point, I think it's very dangerous to elect a president while marginalizing a large part of the Lebanese today. Hezbollah could reorganize at some point, use this and, you know, turn the narrative into this is them trying to marginalize the Shia of Lebanon. And I think there's a real danger today of civil strife. We're seeing it on the ground. There's a lot of tension, including with hosting displaced people, as simple as that. People refusing to host the displaced because of fears of strikes from Israel, because Israel has bombed residential buildings, including displaced people, under the pretext that it's going specific targets. So I think, you know, a lot of Lebanese want a Lebanese president to be elected soon, but we have to be very careful. How is that going to happen? Today, the Americans are calling for 1559. We're not just talking about 1701, as you mentioned. 1559 is for the disarmament of Hezbollah. And I do also believe there's a majority of Lebanese who would embark on that, but not coming from Israel and the U.S.
Let me bring in Bilal on this. Bilal Saab, do you agree that it's very difficult to force the Lebanese Speaker of Parliament, Nabih Berri's hand, and to get them to agree on a president right this second?
Yeah, of course it's difficult, but it's quite necessary at this point. Who is actually on behalf of the Lebanese? I mean, somebody. You need somebody who had authority and who could speak for all Lebanese, regardless of what kind of being imposed on all of Lebanon. We do not have an answer. So I think this is obviously an issue that the Lebanese have to take care of themselves without a from the outside. But the bottom line, which is that you got a caretaker government that has very limited responsibilities at this point. There's no president, and all of them are being blocked by Hezbollah. Something's got to give, and frankly, this is a responsibility for the Lebanese to figure out.
Bertrand Besancenot, you were in Lebanon just a couple of months ago. That power vacuum, how strong is it, and how do you feel it?
No, I think that the state of Lebanon, unfortunately, is very weak. And the fact is that all the actors, both in Lebanon but outside the country, it is true for Iran, it is true for Israel, it is true for all the other actors, are waiting to know who will be the next U.S. president. Because for one good reason.
So hold on. So no ceasefire negotiations before November 5th and no Lebanese president either.
I think so, personally, yes. And because for one good reason, either it is Kamala Harris, and she said that while supporting Israel, at the same time, she was in favor of regional negotiation, even with the Iranians. But on the other hand, of course, President Trump said that apparently, he would go back to the policy of major pressure on Iran, even if at the same time he thinks that he's the master of all the transactions. But the feeling nearly everywhere is that many things, all the different actors, the Gulf countries and the Westerners and others, will define their policy, taking into account what will be the U.S. policy in the region, because simply the U.S. are the only country which can make pressure on Israel.
Okay, so you have the ramped-up pressure that we've seen since last Thursday's killing of Yahya Sinwar on Lebanon, ramped-up pressure on the Gaza Strip, particularly around the northern Jabalia refugee camp outside of Gaza City, residents of the northern Gaza Strip accusing Israel of besieging hospitals and shelters while detaining men and ordering women to leave. There is something going on, too, when it comes to dialogue there. It appears, what with the head of the domestic intelligence services, Shin Bet, visiting Cairo and meeting with the new Egyptian intelligence chief, the two discussing, according to Middle East Monitor, pushing forward a hostage deal at this point. Gil Mihaly, again, you know, they're after Sunday's cabinet meeting in Israel, Israeli press was talking about two scenarios, the little de-escalation scenario, which would and a big one, what Ambassador Besancenot was talking about, involving the wider region, or the little one, perhaps just getting some kind of deal that would bring the hostages home from Gaza.
We actually don't know who is able to make decisions about the hostages because the situation in Gaza is so chaotic. I'm not sure that even Sinwar in the last weeks of his life could give an order concerning all the hostages dead or alive.
And that's a problem. The French realized it in Algeria when they had either captured or killed all of the insurgents at one point, and they realized they didn't have enough interlocutors.
Yes, exactly. The catch in Gaza was that the red line for Netanyahu is not to agree to a definitive ceasefire. Because if you have a definitive ceasefire, Hamas will immediately start preparing the next 7 October. So you need to have an agreement that allows civilian reconstruction, but allows Israel to destroy tunnels, to destroy missiles, to destroy Nukba, to destroy the capacities that Hamas had as a military organization before October 7th. And of course, this is very, very much to demand, but it is a red line for Israel. Because it is clear that if there is a definitive ceasefire in Lebanon or in Gaza, it's deja vu all over again, as a great American said. So this is the problem. In Lebanon, we are talking about things that are unacceptable regarding Lebanese sovereignty, but it doesn't exist. What is the problem with Lebanon? Lebanon doesn't exist politically. There is no nation. There is no nation state. This is why from 1958 onwards, this country was so politically weak that either Nasser or the Palestinians or the Syrians or the Iranians, they just used it as a political tool. Without the Lebanese harnessing the capabilities that the French, the Italians, the Israelis, the New Zealanders.
We're seeing it, and we saw it in the report filed by our correspondents, that there's been incredible shows of solidarity the last weeks. The Lebanese, are in terms of housing the displaced, the Lebanese feel attachment and as a nation.
You know, the Greek felt an attachment as Greek, and then the Athenians fought to death the Spartan. It doesn't mean anything. There is no political anthropology. There is no Lebanese body politic, and this is the sad truth. They cannot create institutions that are working for the general interest, for the common good.
Right, but my question
was... They have a confederation of private interests. So if you are an island in the Pacific, it can work. If you have a neighbor like Canada, it can work. It can't work when you have Syrians, when you have Palestinians...
So what you're suggesting is that there'll never be a deal?
I don't know, but it can take time, you know.
Right.
We always get to the question of state and nation building.
Bilal Saab, is that how you read it?
I think you pretty much know my answer. First of all, I don't know what the relation issues that we're having with Mr. Xi, or is it really his view? But what I just heard, what do you mean by there's no nation Lebanon, there's no nation state? I think he's confusing weakness non-existent. So I'm just quiet for a moment. Frankly, I'm not concerned with those comments. What I'm more concerned about is moving forward with diplomacy. Yes, we do recognize that in Lebanon there and political situation that has to be dealt with, but I will say that only the Lebanese can handle that. I think that there is an opportunity now to come up with something that resembles 1701, but actually with teeth, right? So something that forced, but once again, I'll repeat it, not by the Israelis, but by the international community, by a UNIFIL presence, by more than probably 9,000 Lebanese troops that can actually enforce it. And I don't want to see there that actually provides the Israelis the ability to enforce it. Why would you want to have something like this in a document? I mean, you already had the ability to do it no matter what. There is no nation whatsoever that will willingly lose its sovereignty in order to allow its adversary to violate its airspace whenever it wants. So have the ability, they've always had that ability. Why would you want to put it in an international document of diplomacy?
Let me bring in this on this Bertrand Besancenot. That brings us back to that statement from the readout of the phone call that took place this Monday between France's president, Israel's prime minister, Emmanuel Macron, saying that Yahya Sinwar's death must be an opportunity to begin a new phase of negotiation.
Yeah.
Are we into a new phase? Is there a new phase ahead? Is that possible?
No, frankly speaking...
What we've just been talking about?
No, frankly speaking, for the time being, it is clear that neither Netanyahu nor the Hezbollah or the Hamas want to have an agreement for the time being. This is, in my view, very clear. It doesn't mean that because of the situation in Lebanon, which risks to be destroyed if we go on for a long period of fighting like this one, that something cannot be done in terms of trying to find a first agreement on something. But it will be difficult for the reason I gave, that nobody for the time being is ready to compromise on its ambitions.
All right, let's talk about what we've seen, the to and fro between Emmanuel Macron and Benjamin Netanyahu. Quite a bit of banter of late. Sunday, for instance, we saw the Israeli foreign minister threatening legal action over France's ban on Israeli companies that take part in war from attending the upcoming Euro-Naval Arms Fair. That doesn't mean all Israeli groups are banned from this trade fair. And last Friday, at an EU summit, Emmanuel Macron calling for a ceasefire in Lebanon.
It's in this context that France calls on Israel to end its military operations, not to extend its ground action there, and to respect Lebanon's sovereignty as well as its obligations to the United Nations, particularly with regard to UNIFIL.
Okay, this Monday, Macron and Netanyahu again speaking on the phone, and there was a readout, in that readout of the call, it's interesting what they also said about Iran. The President of the Republic marking his determination to engage with Tehran's authorities in a dialogue that calls them to account on Iran's nuclear program, ballistic program, and regional policy. First of all, your thoughts on the mudslinging we've seen between the French and Israeli leaders?
It is always unfortunate to hear this kind of exchange of wording, of course, between countries.
Is it just a bit of brinkmanship or just what's it about?
No, but there is a sense that nobody wants really to negotiate or to find a solution. It is what President Macron thinks about Netanyahu's policy. And this is clear that as we have a special responsibility concerning Lebanon, to see what is happening right now, we have to do something. Now, coming to Iran, clearly the Iranians don't want to have a direct war with Israel because they know that their inferiority in terms of weapons, in terms of capabilities, this is clear. And they know that it will be dangerous because of their political domestic situation, because of the economic situation, and because their proxies have lost part of their credibility as well. So for the time being, they are just hoping to see if Kamala Harris is elected and if there is a possibility of negotiation. And for the time being, in French, we say they are making le gros dos. That means they are trying to win some time.
Hunker down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To win some time. This is clearly. But on the opposite, Netanyahu exactly feels that he has a free hand during that period to go as far as he can to destroy everything that threatens Israel's security.
Is it just a bit of political entertainment, what's happening between Macron and Netanyahu?
In 2006, there was a Hezbollah aggression. Then there was the Israeli reaction. And the crisis ended mainly thanks to the intervention of Jacques Chirac, who negotiated with others, of course, the diplomatic solution, 1701. The problem is that Macron is basically proposing Netanyahu the same solution 18 years later when we know that it doesn't work. As for the language, you know, there's a new... We were used to diplomats who say many words like yes, prime minister, to say nothing. And now there is a new, you know, in the United States, in Israel, there's a new fashion in diplomats, and they talk like YouTubers or they talk like Twitters. It's the new style in diplomacy. I prefer the old style.
So, Dalal Mawa, do you agree that Emmanuel Macron is no Jacques Chirac when it comes to the Middle East?
I think the last time France had influence, not just in Lebanon, but also in the Arab world, was with Jacques Chirac. I think this is, you know, that we see a retreat of France's foreign policy in the wider Arab world. I don't think France anyway has the upper hand when it comes to this conflict, whether it's with the Israelis. It's trying in Lebanon. It has, you know, the capacity to dialogue with Iran and Hezbollah because it doesn't consider the political wing of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. But I don't think France's position is strong enough. It's been very ambiguous. There's a lot of back and forth in Macron's position. And at the end of the day, you know, calling for an arms embargo, which, you know, Emmanuel Macron has proposed before. France only exports 0.2%. It's nothing essential. I think the leverage needs to go at the level of the EU. Where's the EU in all of this? It's not united. There's not one voice. Why isn't the EU using any leverage? It's Israel's first trade partner, economic partner. France could go that way, putting pressure at the EU level. But I mean, in summary, yes, it's been intensifying its diplomatic efforts, but I don't think it's able to really be a game changer in this scenario.
Abil Saab, we're all sitting here in our climate-controlled studio in Paris, waiting for there to be an election where you are. Basically, there's nothing the likes of an Emmanuel Macron can do right now.
I'm being told my audio is not very good. Can you hear me, François?
You're much better now.
Okay, I'm sorry, whatever happened before. Listen, obviously I agree with Abil and also with the previous speaker. What happened in 06, obviously the French played an instrumental role in diplomacy, but you got to remember that the Bush administration played a decisive role in getting kind of a ceasefire and diplomatic agreement. Also, Ehud Olmert's political position in Israel was one of the factors basically led to 1701. But nothing's changed since then. I think the American role remains the most important one, except that this time around, you're not seeing the kind of leadership, you're not seeing the kind of involvement. To your point now about the elections, look, it's a pretty tight race. I'm not sure really what dramatically is going to change in terms of U.S. foreign policy writ large, but also U.S. Middle East policy more specifically. I expect that President Trump will have a little bit of a different relationship with the Israelis, giving them a little bit more flexibility in what they wish to accomplish in the Middle East, be it redrawing, the balance of power, the map, whatever you want to call it, in the words of Bibi Netanyahu. But I am very much concerned. I think you sort of raised that in the very beginning, François. I am concerned with months. You got this is not just until November. Also, in January when somebody is in the Oval Office and resumes duties, it's kicking the can down the road, but I'm so hoping that I'm wrong on this one, that there will be actually some serious diplomacy entertained. But there is that fear, there is that concern that, with no serious U.S. involvement until there's actually someone, in the Oval Office, it might just be that you're going to see a continuation of this conflict, obviously flowing in intensity. But I hope I'm wrong on this one.
Bertrand Besancenot, a final word on this?
I would say that there is a general fear that if Mr. Trump is elected, as he said, he would let Mr. Netanyahu do whatever he wants. And this is, of course, a matter of concern for Lebanon and for the whole area.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. So much more to talk about, Ambassador Besancenot. I want to thank you. I want to thank as well Gil Mihaly.
Maybe Hochstein's new haircut is a promising sign.
Okay. We're talking about trying to read the tea leaves. I want to thank Bilal Saab in Washington, Dalal Mawad for being with us as well. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.